Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own. We are thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 382 of Registry Matters. Larry, has your blood pressure come down yet?
Not yet.
You were kind of going off there for a minute. let's just dive right in. Forget all that stuff about liking and subscribing, but whatever. So, hey, what are we doing tonight?
Well, we have a case to dissect from the United States District Court for the Southern District of West Virginia. Now, it's not a final decision. It's a case in progress, but we're going to dissect where we are because these things that are happening right now are routine, normal, and they need to be explained to people so they don't say, well, how come it's taking so long for our case? So we're going to kind of go through the steps of how a case develops. Also, we have a few questions from our vast listening audience to go through.
And you're saying that cases aren't like going to McDonald's and getting a Happy Meal and walking out in 3 minutes?
No, unfortunately, civil cases take years. And there's no timeline. See, like with a criminal case, there are speedy trial rights and things that can move a case along faster, and they have priority. In a civil case, they can really just linger for a long time, depending on the complexity and how bad the opposing party is, how much resistance they're putting up. And the states typically put up lots of resistance because they have unlimited budgets. And we've beat that quite a bit about the states that guard the purse. They spend the most money putting up the most frivolous arguments for the longest periods of time, and that's going to unfold in this case as well when we get into it later.
All right. Well, yeah, that's a few segments for now. So this is our new patron. Is that correct? I think I sent that to you today. Same guy?
Yes, it is. I believe so.
A North Carolina sheriff gave a man permission to travel to a wedding. The man followed every instruction, came home, and got arrested anyway, over a rule a deputy invented. The court stripped away qualified immunity. Andy and Larry have thoughts. Patrons can watch the show get recorded live, mistakes and all. Become one at patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right, so I have been on Virginia's SOR since a conviction in 1998. The trooper, we'll call him Handler, who watches over me is sure that all of the newer regulations and laws apply to me. I say no, unless it, quote unquote, the law, specifically says it is retroactive to include me. One example is the newest law in Virginia about visiting a park. The key being to meet a child for illegal contact. Of course, just because will be their argument. Because whether you admit it or not, they know your intent. So how do we challenge the idea that all these restrictions are retroactive to people like me? Interesting question. Yeah, how do you navigate that? And I mean, can you just like hold up the piece of paper and be like, bang, 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 bang. Here, look, this doesn't apply to me.
So, well, this is a good question. And didn't have a lot of time to work on it because you sent it to me, 2 hours before the program?
I think it was earlier than that, but give or take, yes.
But I'm not sure that this is actually a law in Virginia. I did a quick AI summary, and I located this, and I'm going to read it. But if it is a law, I would like for Grouchy Old Man to show me some evidence that it is a law, because I found Senate Bill 1108 from the 2025 session. And it says, this bill amends Virginia law to expand restrictions on sex offenders' proximity to children by adding state parks to the list of locations where convicted sex offenders are prohibited from approaching. Specifically, starting July 1, 2025, any adult convicted of an offense prohibiting proximity to children will be permanently banned from coming within 100 feet of playgrounds, athletic fields, or facilities, or gymnasiums located within state parks when the purpose is to have contact with children who are not in their custody. Now, I like that wording. with an offense prohibiting proximity to children includes various serious sex offenses involving minors, such as kidnapping, sexual assault, indecent liberties, and child porn. The bill classifies a violation of this prohibition as a Class 6 felony, which is the lowest level felony in Virginia. And the law applies not only to those convicted in Virginia, but to individuals convicted of similar offenses in other jurisdictions. But my research shows that the bill died, so I'd like to have additional information. But I can still answer the question. How you would challenge it would be you would have to get ready to be in litigation for years, and you'll have to overcome a few hurdles of showing that you have standing. So your conviction is going to have to fit within this criteria, however broadly they've defined it. And you're going to have to show that you are a person who potentially this would apply to. And then you would assert a number of challenges, including the 100 feet. How would you know? How would you know that? Just out of curiosity, do you have the ability to measure 100 feet with your in your possession at all times?
No. I would have to get to my computer. I could do it that way, but not on my phone at any time. No.
So, but it says banned from coming within 100 feet of athletic fields, blah, 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 within state parks. But the purpose is to have contact with children. So I see a claim there for a state park that you pay taxes to support. So you've got you're being banned from something that your tax dollars work to pay for. And I see the vagueness of it, of how would you enforce the 100 feet? How would you know it? And then, of course, the purpose to have contact with children who are not their own. What does contact mean?
So you've got your gym shorts on and your shoes on, and you're like, I am going to the state park where they have a track that's measured out to quarter miles, and I'm going to go do my 2-mile run. My purpose is to go do the run. There happen to be children there. How would you, you should be able to defend that somewhat easy, but it's just your word against anybody else's of what your purpose is.
So, yes, this is creativity at its best, but the question I have is, did it become law? And if so, then we would need to see it in the statutory scheme, which I have not. And if it didn't become law, did the Virginia authorities try to promulgate it as a regulation? And they're trying to apply it, although it's not law. And that would be funny if they did that, if they thought, well, gee, this is a great law. We'll just promulgate this as a regulation in the PFR regulatory scheme. Wouldn't that be funny?
I could see that the handlers go to some kind of training saying that here's some law that's coming down the pike. Make sure your people are complying with it. And then the bill dies. And nobody ever came back in their training and says, oh, by the way, you don't have to do that. You shouldn't do this anymore because it doesn't apply.
So, yeah, I can see that as well.
So what's your advice to our new patron, Grouchy Old Man?
Well, my advice is always very politely to ask for the statutory citation to it. I can tell you all day something's against the law, but I should be able to tell you. It's New Mexico statute annotated, blah, blah, blah. They should be able to tell you that. They should be able to say, actually, right, it is the law, and here's the number. And if they do that, if you don't do it with a piss-poor attitude, if you're polite about it and say, you know, I've been following the legislature pretty carefully, and I saw this bill, but I think it died, and did it become law? You know, what section? Where is it in the code? Because I want to be very familiar with it and make sure I don't violate it. And, you know, I told you it's there. It's not good enough. I'd like to see it.
Right. And I assume, Larry, you ultimately have to be, depending on how bad you want to fight this, you have to be willing to get locked up and go to some kind of hearing and probation violation and whatnot and go before a judge and have the judge say, let this guy go because this is not in any sort of law anywhere that he violated anything. Like, you have to be willing to go that far.
Well, that's one way to get a constitutional challenge going, but you don't have to wait for arrest as long as you're within a credible zone of enforcement. If this is in fact law, and a person in Virginia has said that has enforcement authority, I put my hand on that Bible, and I'm going to enforce this law, then you've got all the credible threat of enforcement you need to preemptively strike. So you can preemptively strike. You don't have to wait for arrest. The problem is that people preemptively strike when there is no credible threat of enforcement, when something's not even the law. I've heard of people that are on the West Coast attacking regulations that are not statute and don't have enforcement power, and no one had even scoffed and suggested that there would be any enforcement. That is reckless litigation. But if someone raises their hand and says, like the sheriff over in Columbia County, Georgia did with the school bus stops, you remember that about 15 years ago?
That's actually before my time.
Well, we've talked about it on podcasts with Wendy Whitaker. Yeah. He said, I put my hand on the Bible, and I think he actually did say that. He said, I swore an oath and under the penalty of the Bible. He either said Bible or perjury, but he said, I swore an oath, and I'm going to enforce the laws in my county. Well, then Wendy had everything she needed. She had a law, and she had a credible threat of enforcement because the person in charge of enforcement said, I'm going to do that because I swore I would.
Very well. So we need a follow-up back from Groucho Man, whether this is actually law or not, and has anybody threatened you within inches of your life of arresting you and all that?
That'll be good, and we can cover it in a future episode with more information.
Fabulous.
A giant verdict against a social media company sounds like a win, until you read what the state wants next. Age checks that mean handing your government identification to every website, and encryption stripped out entirely. Andy and Larry explain who really pays for that. Support the fight, and at higher levels, you get one-on-one time with Larry. Go to patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right, well then, another question. This one came from Rebecca. It says, my boyfriend is a PFR, about 6 months out, and we can't find him work. He's an experienced cook with no degree and a bad driving record, so restaurant kitchens seem like the answer. California's 290.95 says he can't work in an unaccompanied setting with minors or have supervision or disciplinary power over them. His PO first said back of the house was fine since cooks are usually adults. So we applied to about 40 different places. Then we found out some restaurants hire teens as cooks. And when he finally got a hold of his PO again, she reversed herself. If any minor works in the back with him, he can't take the job. So my question is, how is that condition supposed to be read? It says unaccompanied setting with and disciplinary power, but it's being enforced as a total ban on any kitchen where a teenager might also work. What do you do when your PO's interpretation shifts mid-search and lands stricter than the words on the page?
That is the toughest question someone has asked in a long time, because I generally suggest that people do what their probation officers tell them to do and not buck the system. But supervision or disciplinary power over them seems to be pretty straightforward, right?
I think so. I mean, like if you built an org chart, that means you are a line above that person, right?
Right. So under the standard, the way that's being articulated now, he basically can't work anywhere at all, because there are very few jobs that don't hire teenagers if they can find them. Now, the funny thing is teenagers don't participate in the workforce like they used to 30, 40, 50 years ago. The ratio is very low compared to then, but teenagers are still welcomed in the workforce. And under this interpretation, he couldn't work anywhere. I mean, he might could work an adult bookstore, but see, that would violate his probation because it would have stimuli. So he couldn't do that.
right. I mean, even like Olive Garden, which the servers all have to be above age because they're serving alcohol. So whether your state is 18 or 21 to serve, those people are at least all. But then you've got all the bussers, and they are possibly going to be under 18. And so, maybe even like a dishwasher or somebody else working back there could be underage.
It would be very unlikely that in a restaurant of any size that you would have no teenagers, period. You'll have a lot fewer than what we used to have, but having done. My first thought is that I certainly wouldn't have called my probation officer. If I had the original guidance, I wouldn't call my PO and say, oh, by the way, you know, I found a job that I might can take, but there's a teenager working in the back. I mean, I wouldn't have done that. And
right,
then
the
question would become, how would the PO know? Is the PO going to come barge in the restaurant, go barging in the back of the house, and going to take an inventory of who's working and ask for their dates of birth? I mean, don't be silly, folks. So, and how often would that be checked? There could be no teenager working at the back of the house time he gets a job, and one could start next week.
That's true.
So like, I mean, folks, you don't need to call your PO every time you breathe. You really don't. So
some people think that they do. I cannot make a move. It's like, okay, it's time to get out of bed. Hey, PO, can I get out of bed now?
So I'm not wanting to make fun of the person, but I think you can be a little bit too paranoid. They're supposed to provide you your basic conditions in writing. You can't be expected to comply with something you haven't seen. So therefore, I would have taken the unaccompanied minors or have supervision or disciplinary power over them. Well, unaccompanied minors, I don't know exactly what that means, because very few minors are accompanied by an adult when they're working. I can't think of a single job I've had where...
Yes, mom and dad are there holding the hand, supervising the kid.
Now, special needs minors might have, special needs adults might have accompaniment, but I can't think of how this would work out. So I would largely disregard that if it were me, not you, but if it were me, I would say, this doesn't make any sense. It's kind of like don't drive, but especially don't drive. Do you remember your condition?
I do recall this one explicitly.
Yeah,
I got a funny story for you.
And you showed
this
it to
one,
me.
This one will blow your head. I was kind of like on an emergency, a impromptu road trip last weekend to go see something that was a short-lived event, and ran through a McDonald's to get lunch real quick. And they told us to pull up to, to wait because they were cooking the fries or whatever. Pulled up. Waited there for a second, and then I'm going to say a child, but a very, very, very young person showed up. I was like, holy crap, man, how old are you? He was 14. There's a 14-year-old working at a McDonald's not too far away from here. And I was like, what in the hell? And I look back at my kid. I'm like, you just got your first job and you're 19. So anyway, 14.
Well, that was the case back in my day. You could get special permission. You had to get a work permit or some type. You could. The
Correct.
Normal working age was 16 in Georgia, but you could work earlier with permission.
Yep, you had to get some kind of little permission slip. You may have had to have your school sign off on it, too. I had a job somewhere in the 13 or 14 range scooping ice cream at Baskin-Robbins. Back in my day!
This is something where... I think there might be an overreaction to the thing, because I would focus on the supervision disciplinary. So I don't supervise anybody here. I'm just a cook.
Right.
I don't do the hiring. I
yep.
don't do the firing. And I really can't control who comes in and out of the kitchen. You know, they hire people. So I would say, I'm trying to understand, how would I ever work anywhere? Because unless he works on an oil platform somewhere out in the Permian Basin, New Mexico, I can't think of jobs where teenagers are not allowed to work.
And if you're a cook, going back to the Olive Garden example, like someone comes back and says, make me some pasta, whatever, you make the pasta. You're not directing someone over there to help prepare this thing also. So if you're just a line cook, short order cook, whatever the terms are, I'm not in the kitchen vernacular to know. You're not supervising anybody over there. And Larry, if you ask someone, hey, can you get me a rag? Did you then supervise them? Is that all it would take to cross that boundary?
So, I don't know. But the final question he asked is, what do you do when your PO's interpretation shifts mid-search? What you do if it's really push comes to shove, if you must, you ask for a judicial interpretation. But if you're on probation, not parole, then we go to a court. If you're on parole, then it goes through a bureaucracy rather than a court. But going to a court is going to be a last resort, because when you go to court on your PO, things are not going to go well going forward from that point on. They're not going to take it as a laughing matter. They're going to say, well, how come you didn't come talk to me? Well, of course you did come talk to them. They forgot all about it. You did. You only went to court because they would not give you a reasonable interpretation. So you asked the judge to interpret it.
Right. All right.
A Michigan man reported his new address early, then got prosecuted because the old tenant would not move out. His diligence became the evidence against him. Now the state Supreme Court says the ruling that struck down that law reaches backward. Andy and Larry explain who that could free. Patrons hear it early, with no ads. Sign up at patreon.com/registrymatters.
Well then, last, before we move along, so question from Heidi says, my family member has about 10 months left on probation and needs to move to New York. He's already done a year and a half of home detention, has been released on good behavior, but he's still under strict monitoring. The move isn't optional. He needs a medical specialist there and family who can help care for him, and we've already worked around the 1,000-foot school restriction. The problem is nobody can tell us how to actually do it. Every New York lawyer he's consulted is baffled by transferring residents during probation. His own PO says it's not her job, and his home state lawyer has never had a case like it. When we get down to the real details, whether he can buy property, what order things happen in, how long he stays registered in each state during the transition, every attorney and his PO give us completely opposite answers. So my question is, who actually handles an interstate transfer while you're still on probation, and how does someone cut through all this conflicting information to get it done right? This one has your name written all over it, Larry.
Yeah, it sure does. And I don't understand the complexity of it, because it actually does start with your supervising probation officer. There's a little thing that confuses me. I just caught as you read that. It said his home state lawyer has never had a case like that. That implies he's not living in the state that he was convicted in. Does it not?
Oh.
Does it not imply that to you?
That could be. So now we have a three-state kind of thing going on.
So, but nonetheless, It works the same way, even if he's already on interstate compact. But you as an offender don't do anything other than express your desire that you would like to move, because moving, although it's medically necessary, it's still a privilege to be allowed to transfer your supervision. We're assuming this is state-imposed supervision, that we're making that assumption. Federal works completely different, but we're going to assume this is a state conviction. And the probation people initiate the paperwork. They put forth an application through an electronic system, and that's where your ICOTS comes in. That's the name of the system. But they put forth an electronic application to the state you'd like to go to. 10 months is more than enough of time. There's a limit. I don't remember. I haven't looked at that compact. It's either 3 or 6 months. You have to have a minimum period of time on probation. But 10 months is enough for it to be transferred. And since he has a PO, we can tell it's not unsupervised, because he wouldn't have a PO if it was unsupervised. So the PO, it actually is that PO's job to initiate the process if they choose to. Remember, you don't have the right. So they can initiate the application through interstate compact computerized system. There's a whole checklist of things they need: a copy of the sentencing order, conditions of supervision, a basic workup, and it'll go to the state of New York, and they'll send it out to their field office close to where he wants to live, the nearest office that would be supervising him, and they'll do an investigation to see if the residents would meet their criteria. They have 45 days to do that. And they will notify the state that put in the application that they accepted or that they did not accept. If they do not accept, then you got to start all over again. If they accept it, they'll issue what's called reporting instructions. And the offender will be given time to make it to New York to report in. It's real simple about what happens. All of the punishment imposed at that original court of conviction will follow you to New York. Every single last bit of it. Fines will follow you. Restitution will follow you. The amount of duration you'll be supervised will follow you. That whole paperwork goes, and New York would act as if they are as agents on behalf of the state that convicted you. The only thing that doesn't follow you is the cost of your supervision. It will be set by New York. But, and your registration will be set by New York. whatever state convicted you is out of the picture. New York will determine what you, how long you register if you're there and how frequently you report for registration. So I don't know where he's having all the complexity, because all this is really straightforward and very simple. So.
Yeah, but okay, to be fair, Larry, I tried to do this, and this is, I'm pretty sure this is before I even met you, and I got my probation people to approve it, and I worked on an address, and then ultimately the address of where I was trying to move wasn't approved, and like, I mean, it wasn't impossible to navigate. I didn't need to get an attorney involved at all, I don't think. I just asked probation, could I do it, and they said, well, put in the paperwork. They weren't at all happy about doing it, because any paperwork that they have to do, they're not happy about, you know? And then, I don't know, 45 days goes by and it wasn't approved, even though it was basically across the street from a police station. They didn't want me there either. But who would they, like, if an attorney doesn't know, do you just then dial the next attorney down in the yellow pages?
Well, see, I don't see the necessity of an attorney. I would go in and say, I'm really confused because there's a process to transfer interstate, and it starts with my current supervising. If you're in prison, it starts with a prison, you know, with your transition plan. But if you're already out in the community, it starts with the supervising people. You can't make your own application. You just can't. You can't submit it. It has to. It's kind of like those international travel. They have to come from police. These applications yeah. have to be going from state to state, not from offender to state.
And you just ask your PO to initiate it, and they initiate it.
Well, they have the choice. Some states like to hold on to their offenders because it leads itself to a larger budget, New Mexico being sure. one of them. Sure. They wouldn't want a sex offender to leave New Mexico. Now, I'm just the opposite. I want to get rid of as many as we can. Because if you're going to be offending, and there will be a small percentage, it will be, I would rather you be offending in Ohio than here.
God, why do you hate on Ohio so bad?
Well, I just picked that state because we happen to have somebody in there. But I mean, I can't see the logic. Yes, the offense reoffense rate is very low, but it goes to zero if they're not there. I mean, can you argue with that mathematically? If you're not here, you cannot offend here.
Oh, that's totally true. It's totally true.
Well, I would rather you be offending of that 3 to 4 to 5%. I would rather you be offending someplace else. So I'd want to get rid of as many as quick as I can.
But if you're trying to justify your job, then as the other point you were making, if you're trying to justify your existence, then you having more people than fewer makes your job security that much stronger.
Well, that's the higher level bureaucracy. The employee yeah. doesn't see their job in jeopardy. They think they're overworked already. But the bureaucracy going up the food chain, they realize if they lose 100 offenders, they've just lost 4 PO positions.
What about this person going over their PO's head to their supervisor?
I wouldn't do that until I exhausted. If the person says, I'm not, we don't transfer people, then it's dead. You're not being transferred. Okay. But if they say, I ain't going to do the work, say, you know, well, I've got medical needs that I'm really going to have to get this addressed. So if you can't do it, who do you recommend I talk to? Because I've got to get this done.
Back to the other times we've mentioned going over their head. They're going to come down with an anvil on your head next time they come around to check your property.
They are absolutely, most cases are. Now, if you're in Maryland, where it's pure wind driven snow, they probably wouldn't do that. But if you're any place else, good chance.
And somebody in chat says transfers are considered a privilege. Not saying that's right, but so they can just say no, and that's the end of that conversation?
There are a few exceptions, but yes, generally that's a few exceptions. If you're in the military, for example, and the government orders you to go to another place, now, honestly, that provision's overused because nobody in the military is under supervision.
True.
But there are a few mandatory transfer cases that where they have to do it. But I don't think this is going to qualify as one of them. The fact that he has medical needs, I don't think it's going to qualify as a mandatory. I don't remember anything in the compact about that.
Really? I mean, like, and you're telling me that the only doctor on the planet is in New York? Really?
Well, I think she said more than that. She said the support structure and stuff is there.
Well, there was that too, sure. That way the person would be able to stay there in 1,000-foot restrictions and all that stuff, but needs a medical specialist. And short of it being some super advanced cancer research, something or another. There are doctors everywhere. I understand the support system.
Well, there's some states that have shortages, but like I say, it's going to be things where I'm going to tread very gently and try to get it done through the process of not having to go over their head. But if he must go and the PO won't do it, say, are you sure? Because I'm going to really need to try to talk to somebody to get this done. And if it's not your job, we need to find out whose job it is.
Understand.
A giant verdict against a social media company sounds like a win until you read what the state wants next. Age checks that mean handing your government identification to every website and encryption stripped out entirely. Andy and Larry explain who really pays for that. Support the fight, and at higher levels, you get one-on-one time with Larry. Go to patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right, well then, let's move over to this final segment that we have here that is going on in the western version of Virginia, right? This is West Virginia. And I spent all my time today, I read the court's order thoroughly, so you better be prepared for some tough questions. Are you?
Well, I hope I am.
All right, well, let's see what you got. All right, the case is John Doe number 1 et al. Versus James L. Mitchell. It's pending in the United States District Court of the Southern District of West Virginia. Is this a NARSL case?
It is indeed. Now, what does NARSL stand for? What's the acronym, and what does it stand for?
The acronym is NARSOL, and it's the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws.
Okay, so we're going to give NARSL a shout out. This is their case.
Yes, because we do that quite frequently, to be honest with you, pretty regularly. All right, well, then let me set this up. The plaintiffs, Does 1 through 3, are convicted individuals who are registered under the West Virginia PFR Registry pursuant to the West Virginia PFR Act. And the defendant is Colonel James L. Mitchell, who serves as superintendent of the West Virginia State Police. That's the agency responsible for enforcing the West Virginia SORA. The plaintiffs, both individually and on behalf of members of a proposed class, are challenging West Virginia Code 15-12-2D8. They allege that it violates both First and 14th Amendments. Now, can you tell me what this code is and what it requires?
West Virginia Code 15-12-2D subsection 8 requires registered PFRs to disclose and provide the West Virginia State Police information relating to any internet accounts the registrant has and any screen names, usernames, or aliases the registrant uses on the internet. Also, it requires that any change in the registrant's internet accounts be reported to the West Virginia State Police in person within 12 business days, within 10 business days, which typically requires an appointment and requires new photographs and fingerprints to be taken.
Now, what was the last thing you said?
Apparently, according to the court, PFR visits in West Virginia require that fingerprints and photographs be taken every time they're there. And I know I'm going to get you to admit. Can you admit this is funny, especially since West Virginia is a state that guards taxpayer resources so well?
I'm trying. So, like, I go set up a new... No, it's not funny, by the way. I go set up a new email account somewhere, and within 10 days, I have to go get my finger, butt, toes, and photographs taken?
Correct. But remember, I'm harping on this. They guard the taxpayer resources with their life. They would never do anything duplicative or unnecessary. So that's why it's funny.
I understand. It is not funny. All right. Anyway, so continue on, please.
So failure to disclose any required information, as well as any change in such information, can result in a felony conviction that includes 1 to 5 years of imprisonment. And the West Virginia State Police is permitted to make certain disclosed information available to the public via the registry database on its website.
And I'm thinking that this is not funny. What is the penalty then?
It's up to 5 years imprisonment.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right, so I saw in a footnote, it says, the court notes that the registry on the West Virginia State Police website permits members of the public to search email and usernames of PFRs. Why is this case then significant?
Well, because it likely chills free speech. The plaintiffs asserted that the disclosure requirement violates the First Amendment due to being overly broad. They claim the disclosure requirement specifically targets speakers engaged in online communication, thus targeting conduct with a significant expressive element and having the inevitable effect of singling out those engaged in expressive activity. And they quoted a case I wasn't too fond of that I turned out to be wrong about, Cornelio versus Connecticut back in 2022, decided by the Second Circuit. They allege that it burdens protected speech because it chills the willingness of individuals subject to it to engage in constitutionally protected speech online, knowing that doing so will trigger a reporting obligation to the state. Now, that does seem like credible anyway.
Did they provide any examples of the way that it might chill speech?
They did. They said speech that could be chilled, such as creating an account to leave a comment on a news article or joining a social media platform. The plaintiffs alleged that Section 1512.2d8 burdens the right to speak anonymously. They alleged that that section targets an enormous amount of protected speech that is not narrowly drawn when judged against the legitimate sweep that the statute might have. They claim the information that is compelled to be provided to the state has never or rarely been used for legitimate governmental or law enforcement purposes, such as, for example, to investigate and solve and prevent a crime. Now, that is a very creative argument. I wish I had thought of that.
Well, I guess you don't have to think of it now. It'll be in your quiver now, huh?
So, I like that. To just call them out. Hey, you're full of it. You have never used this for this purpose. I love that.
Now, I noticed that they also asserted that 15-12-2D8 is unconstitutionally vague. They allege that 15-12-2D8 does not define, quote-unquote, internet account, does not define, quote-unquote, information relating to, and does not limit the requirement to social networking platforms, online communities, or accounts used for communication. They asserted that if read broadly, the term, quote-unquote, any internet account could include financial portals, employment platforms, medical accounts, subscription services, retail accounts, or other non-communicative online services. So I can imagine, you go get blood drawn at Quest and you create an account to log into the portal so you can see how your blood draw was. You have to go report that to the state police?
And you got to have your fingerprints made and pictures and all that kind of stuff.
Do they have a good argument, do you think?
I believe they got a very credible argument.
Okay, well then, if we can move over to the meat of the case, the plaintiffs requested an injunction prohibiting the state from continuing to enforce West Virginia Code Annotated 15-12-2D8 and databasing such information online for public search or disclosure. The defendant moved to dismiss the case. That's routine, is that right?
Totally routine and absolutely predictable.
Would you do the deed of describing what the motion reads?
Well, what that motion is, it's standard operating procedure under Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure 12b-6, and you allege that the person failed to state a claim upon which relief could be granted. And it's just a blanket motion that you file because you say, hey, even if everything they said is true, this is not something that the court could grant. So that's what they do. But it does not. This motion doesn't decide the ultimate outcome of the case, and of course, unless the motion is granted. But the rules of procedure requires that a pleading itself contain a short and plain statement of the claim, showing that the pleader is entitled to relief. So I would tell you, here's what they're doing. I'm entitled to relief, and here's why. And additionally, allegations must be simple, concise, and direct. So you don't do a 300-page complaint, but put your whole case. You make it very brief and concise, and you say, the sheriff is violating my constitutional rights. Here's how. Here's what they're doing.
Now, I believe I've heard you say that the court must assume the allegations contained in the complaint are true at this stage of the proceedings?
That is correct. And the judge even affirmed that. The judge stated, the court must accept as true all factual allegations contained in the complaint. The court must also draw all reasonable factual inferences from those facts in the plaintiff's favor. However, statements of bare legal conclusions are not entitled to the assumption of truth and are insufficient to state a claim. Meaning you can't put in legal conclusions for the judge, but you can put the facts. Furthermore, the court need not accept as true unwarranted inferences or unreasonable conclusions or arguments. So you can't just go off on a tangent, but they are supposed to liberally construe the complaint as being true.
Well, so for me, can you make it much more simple? What is required to survive a motion to dismiss?
Good question. To survive a motion to dismiss, a complaint must contain sufficient factual matter accepted as true to state a claim to relief that is plausible on its face. Meaning, I believe what you said, and you've cited enough authority that I could grant this relief, assuming you can prove it going forward. According to a court, a plaintiff must, using the complaint, articulate facts when accepted as true that show that the plaintiff has stated a claim that would entitle him or her to relief. It's a task that requires the reviewing court to draw on its judicial experience and common sense. And I know you don't care much about the term common sense, but that's what the court said.
Sure, because if it were so common, it would be more common. But anyway, and it's also subjective. So the defendant moved to dismiss the plaintiff's claims of constitutional vagueness and overbreadth. The court found that the defendant's motion should be granted as to the vagueness claim and denied as to the overbreadth claim. How did the judge decide to dismiss the vagueness claim?
Well, the defendant argued that that section is not unconstitutionally vague. Defendants asserted that based on its ordinary meaning, the plaintiffs would know that they need to disclose the fact that they have an internet account. Now, you got to give them credit. If you're online, that would seem to be an internet account. The defendants contended that 1512.2d8 requires disclosure not only of information relating to any internet accounts, but also screen names, usernames, or aliases. Information relating to should be understood as requiring information needed for identification purposes. The defendant argued it's clear that plaintiffs understand this applies to any internet account, meaning that it's not limited to accounts involving communications, and that every account must be disclosed. The defendant also argued that the statute's scienter requirement mitigates any vagueness because only those sex offenders who knowingly fail to disclose will be subject to conviction. Now, I don't know if I agree with that, but they argued it. Moreover, the defendant argued that scienter requirement is not required to resolve any vagueness issues because the West Virginia Supreme Court in State versus Nolte back in 2014 interpreted the meaning of this section and found it not to be unconstitutionally vague. Now, I didn't put this in the notes, but a federal court is required to defer to the interpretation of the state's highest tribunal unless it's strictly contrary to the U.S. Constitution, U.S. Supreme Court precedent. So this judge has to rely on State versus Nolte, what the West Virginia Supreme Court said, that it's not vague unless there's a heck of a good strong reason to show that it is vague.
Well, then what did the court hold in terms of the vagueness claim?
Well, the court noted that the West Virginia Supreme Court has previously interpreted this section in State versus Nolte back in 2014. The court is bound by West Virginia Supreme Court's interpretation. The court held that registered sex offenders must disclose all of their internet accounts. The court in Nolte, when interpreting the section, explained that the purpose of the act is to, quote, allow the public and law enforcement to monitor the whereabouts of sex offenders. And while the statute is broad in scope, it is at the same time rather specific. That's what they said at the West Virginia Supreme Court. So that is the law of this case.
Well, the judge also said even without the West Virginia Supreme Court's interpretation, the court finds that this subsection is not unconstitutionally vague. Let's move on to the overbreadth claim. The defendant argued that the plaintiffs failed to meet the difficult burden required to demonstrate such a challenge. He asserted that the complaint does not address the plainly legitimate sweep 15.12.2.d.8 and does not measure its constitutional applications against its unconstitutional applications. He contended that the plaintiffs failed to mention the Act's non-speech-related applications, such as the disclosure of financial reports, medical accounts, subscription services, retail accounts, and other non-communicative online services, which do not implicate the First Amendment. And what are your thoughts on that?
I think the state is nuts.
I think I have a quote for you if you want that.
Run by the strangest collection of misfits, Looney Tunes, since the advent of the Third Reich.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
So they also argue that 15.12.2.d.8 is narrowly tailored because it does not prevent anyone from speaking. Now, this is why I argue with Cornelio, because it doesn't say you can't speak. Its burdens on speech are minor. It leaves open the door to alternative channels of communication. The information revealed is very limited, and it provides the state with an important tool to protect the public by knowing the registrant's online whereabouts, and it applies only to convicted sex offenders required to register. This is what I hung my hat on, because this was the way the case law looked at the time that Cornelio was litigating. And I said, well, you know, you speak all you want to. You just have to disclose that you're speaking. And but apparently, I was wrong.
The defendant argued that the plaintiffs are unable to demonstrate that a substantial amount of the application of 15.12.2.d.8 are unconstitutional, given that it encompasses non-expressive conduct that does not implicate the First Amendment, such as bank accounts, medical accounts, subscription services, and online retail accounts. Now, what did the court decide then?
Well, the court stated that this is an argument for another day, given the standard for analysis under Rule 12b-6. Given the plaintiffs have plausibly alleged that the disclosure requirement of 15.12.2.d.8 burdens protected speech and the right to speak anonymously, the court finds they have plausibly alleged that a substantial amount of its applications are unconstitutional in relation to its legitimate sweep.
And the way that we've set this up, this case still has traction and still moving along?
Correct. The court stated because the plaintiffs have plausibly pled that 15.12.2.d.8 is overbroad, and there's a need for a more developed record as it relates to whether it materially advances the state's interest and is narrowly tailored to serve that interest, the court finds that the motion to dismiss the plaintiff's First Amendment claim must be denied.
And did you say a more developed record?
I did say that. This case needs to be fully developed, and it may or may not be appropriate for summary judgment. And I'm not prepared to say yet if summary judgment is appropriate. I got to see the pleadings.
Do you know much about the federal judge assigned to the case? This seems to be an enlightened ruling coming from a not-so-enlightened state, I must say.
I do. It's an African-American woman who has an amazing life story. Irene Cornelia Berger is the first African-American female judge in West Virginia, serving on the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of West Virginia. Her father worked in the coal mines, which was a standard occupation in that state for many decades, for nearly 41 years, and her mother was a housewife. Both were well-read despite not having completed high school, instilling in her the values of education. Berger earned her Bachelor of Arts in Mathematics from West Virginia University in 1976 and a Juris Doctor from West Virginia University College of Law in 1979. After law school, Berger worked as staff attorney for the Legal Aid Society of Charleston, representing low-income clients in domestic consumer and tenant-landlord disputes from 1979 to 1982. In May of 1984, Berger joined the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of West Virginia as an assistant U.S. attorney. Later in that year, she was appointed by Governor Gaston Caperton as a, pronounce it please, Kanawha?
Kanawha, I believe is what it was.
Kanawha County Circuit Judge, becoming the first African-American woman to hold that position. On July 8, 2009, President Barack Obama nominated Berger to the U.S. District Court to fill the seat vacated by David Faber. She was confirmed back in the good old days, U.S. Senate, when they actually were functioning, on a 97-0 vote, and received her commission just a few days later on November 9th, 2009. So that's the story. It's an amazing story that she's got.
And what will happen next in this case then?
Well, the legal team working on this case must now prove the assertions that they've made in the complaint. They get the chance to have their day in court. Folks, don't blow it. You've got a chance to prove this. So let's do what it takes. If we have to go out and raise more money, if we have to go out and beg, if we have to go over budget, let's win this case.
And your opinion, just Uncle Larry here talking, your opinion is this is a good case?
It is a good case because it's positioned now with Cornelio having done the heavy lifting. We can coast in and use the work that has been done previously. And I'm not sure if they're in the same circuit, but I think they are. But nonetheless, it's still persuasive authority.
And, of course.
So anyway, if anybody wants to do the research and see what circuit West Virginia is in, I didn't bother to do that. But even without it being in the circuit, it is a good persuasive case to use.
Fantastic. Well, very good. Do you have anything that you would like to talk about before we press the stop button?
No, I think this came out to be exactly the amount of time we needed. And we did have the new patron to welcome that we did the question from Grouchy Old, what do you call himself? Grouchy Old Man?
Grouchy Old Man.
And we got that.
Yeah, that's all we need. We don't even need like a quote unquote real name.
So we got that new patron, and barring something where you learn how to be in two places at one time, we won't be able to record next weekend. So we probably won't have an episode unless something dramatic happens and we have to record on a non-regular day.
That is correct. Well, please head over to registrymatters.co for show notes and the other links to go all the places. Email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Old-fashioned voicemail message, 747-227-4477. And please help support the program, and that can be done over patreon.com/registrymatters. All right. Have a great night, Larry. I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.